like
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the 52nd episode of the Mod State Podcast. I hope that your holiday weekend is going well. It is Friday. Let's get everything out of the way quickly. If you like what you hear, go to modstate.com. At the top of the webpage, there are links to all of our social media outlets. You can find me at Twitter at NateWelling_ModState. You can also find me at my Facebook at Nate Welling, where you can find links to all the podcasts. If you are using your cell phone at modstate.com looking for the podcast links, please log on, scroll all the way to the bottom where you can find all the links. If you're on your desktop, laptop, tablet, whatever you use, you can find it on the left-hand side. So John and I do our inaugural TGIF episode. If you remember, on Monday we did a Case of the Mondays. Then we get into net neutrality, crony capitalism, and that's kind of it. Anyway, enough of my blathering. Let's get John on the line.
You want the envelope? There. You take it. It's all yours. You kill all three of them for nothing. You greenhorn, you blockheaded jackass, you nincompoop.
Hollow, what's going on?
Mr. Velan, how are you?
I am doing well, how are you? That's my lame attempt at a German accent, I guess.
Well, hey, we get A's for effort most of the time, so it's
I'll take it. Shit, man, I'll take a B.
We're back.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, taking a drink. We are back.
It's important that the hosts stay hydrated.
Mm-hmm.
And sir, you've got things on your mind. It's like Willie Nelson saying, you know, you were always on my mind.
Oh, it's a pretty good Willie impression. Yeah.
I was always on your behind.
Ooh, that was not Willie Nelson. Good though.
That was
Al Yankovic, probably.
Was it?
Oh, I have no idea.
Either way, I felt like it was just perverse enough to suit us.
Yeah, it works. I like it. Yeah, the whole staying hydrated is a nice balance between staying hydrated and not having to take a huge pee while
I have to go to the bathroom all the time. That's the thing. And you know, we did a, speaking of Willie Nelson, we did a good Willie Nelson Ray Charles duet. The last visit to the land of dreams. Remember, Mettery went to that. Well, it wasn't a karaoke bar, but it was a pool hall with darts and the chick with a jar of cannabis.
Blunt. Yeah, we did. That's one of my favorite songs, Seven Spanish Angels.
It was a good duet.
Indeed.
Next time we'll have to have somebody record that.
Yeah, maybe not.
Us doing it.
I was gonna say maybe not at a billiards bar with.
Or maybe so.
Maybe. Who knows?
Because I tell you, I cannabis can be obtained all kinds of places, but I've never seen somebody with a mason jar.
No.
Oh, you want some cannabis?
Yeah. Or maybe you want
some weed?
Mason jar of weed, but not there in that place. But
I mean, and you know, it looked like good grass.
Yeah, it looked like good grass.
I mean, and it, you know, it's decriminalized in New Orleans now. So it, I mean, kind of a joke. It's kind of always has been, but
it's whatever, man. She should be able to have that jar of weed just as much as she should be able to have that beer.
It's New Orleans, honestly. It's like the Wild West.
Yeah. Well, everyone's a lot happier here in Colorado, unless you're just anti-weed. But then just leave Colorado. It's that simple.
Yeah. I'm coming to visit from. I think it'll be a good, refreshing change of pace of sorts when I come visit from New Orleans. But at the same time, it's not that vastly different in that sense.
No, not really. Different, but yeah, very, very similar. So,
and yet here we are. I'm back with you, sir, on this, and you've got some items. Some of them are rather dire.
Well, yeah, before we get into the dire discussions of the things we would like to chat about, we do have to do our inaugural TGIF. Thank God it's Friday. Thank gosh it's Friday. Thank goodness it's Friday, because we did have the case of the Mondays where we discussed nuclear famine and fallout. So in the spirit of the Thanksgiving holiday, we decided to just keep it light and, of course, hope that everyone is having a wonderful holiday season. And I know I am. You're with your family. I'm with my family. But I think we'll get into it a little bit more on Saturday, but wanted to just go over the basic background of what Thanksgiving is, because we all know that old photo of Puritans at the first Thanksgiving at Plymouth. It was painted in the early 20th century, and I think it depicted Native Americans and pilgrims all sitting beside each other and passing delicious grub.
I'm sure it happened just like that.
May or may not have happened that way. Certainly wasn't painted.
For the sake of school children, their innocence.
Yeah, that works.
Seriously, though, do you really want your children learning about the realities of scalpings and then also pilgrims, raping the land?
Yes, and smallpox given to the indigenous people.
Let's not do that. Let's let children have their innocence.
I was going to say, that sounds like more of a case of the Mondays.
But yeah.
There obviously, historically, there's been this period of Thanksgiving that precedes a harvest. And of course, it's strange that it would be in November, because the harvest in New England occurs well before that. But in the United States, in the United States and Canada, there's a similar timeline for Thanksgiving, but they believe that the celebration started, I think there's two, there's apparently a shrine for the first U.S. Thanksgiving in Charles City County in Virginia. That was in 1619. But they also traced Thanksgiving holiday tradition in 1621 in Plymouth in present-day Massachusetts. And then, of course, the well-recorded one in 1619 in Virginia. I don't know. I think whether that was the Thanksgiving that we all sort of uphold today, I don't know. It was a period of Thanksgiving, whether it was for more religious reasons or not. But it did start in Plymouth and happened in Virginia. So for a history lesson, obviously at around that time, we had colonies in both New England and in Virginia. And then...
good for them.
Yeah, good for them. And then in... there were Thanksgiving proclamations that were made by individuals like John Hancock and General George Washington.
It's like mandatory fun day in the Navy. It's like, you better give thanks, damn it.
Mm-hmm. And,
or else. And
so the Continental Congress as well made these proclamations, and they each said that we need to give thanks to God for events favorable to their causes. So if you were having a shitty day, I guess... you had to find something that...
I think it was the overall spirit of the times. And it was, men like Benjamin Franklin and Alexander Hamilton, they aspired. It was kind of like a 12-step program, your higher power type.
Yeah, maybe. They're more deists, I believe.
Well, yeah, they were more, deistic evolutionists, whichever you prefer. Yeah. But it was a higher power. Obviously, it was important to have something bigger than yourself that you look to, and that's kind of the spirit of it now.
It is the spirit of it, indeed.
Surely there's something to be thankful for.
Of course. And so the President of the United States, George Washington, did proclaim the first national-wide Thanksgiving celebration in America, making November 26th, 1789, as a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many and signal favors of Almighty God. I don't think George Washington was a deist.
No, he was a Christian, practicing Christian.
Clearly.
I don't know the condition of his heart, none of those, but I didn't converse with him. All of it is historical hearsay.
Yes, indeed. Well, by that quote, I think maybe we could make some assumptions, but either way, that is our TGIF for the day in the spirit of Thanksgiving. So please dig into your hearts and into your leftovers and think of something that you can be thankful for. Wow, that was a good
one. We'll elaborate. I'm sure it was beautifully, phrased, and the baritone in your voice always gets me in. We'll leave it here in the sense we're going to elaborate a little bit more on Saturday, but with that said, I would like to say that we are obviously grateful for the opportunity to barely over 4 months into this podcast and about 19 months, the 30th will be 19 months that Mont State's been functioning as an online magazine. And we're obviously grateful, number one, for the nation and the Western society. We're not alone in Western society as in general, that we're able to broadcast the truth, that we have an audience, slowly but surely expanding audience that appreciates the way that we present it editorially, which we're trying to regroup there. But in the podcast, we have an audience that likes the style in which we present said truth. And the fact that, as we're going to do today, we dig up some things that should be mainstream news, but they're not we'll leave the speculations to why, perhaps mm-hmm. for another time. But overall, we're grateful that we have the opportunity to do this and that you all appreciate hearing us. So thank Indeed. You.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. So segue into more darker corners of conversation.
Oh, and thanks, Nate, for letting me come on here regularly.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Anytime. It's a pleasure. It's an honor. And you are co-host, so we do better together.
You're sweet.
So we, in the course of discussing this week, what we wanted to touch on, there has been a increased conversation, increased traffic, if you will, on the conversation of net neutrality. And for those of you who don't know what net neutrality is, it could possibly be the most boring name for an issue. It's almost as if the geeks, when they initially had these conversations they got to name it, and they were like, well, let's keep the net neutral. Net neutrality. Okay. I mean, I don't know what I would come up with that would be more,
greater societal freedom. I mean, it's a pretty pivotal issue, whether you realize it or not.
Exactly. So we'll give
basically, in my opinion, a First Amendment issue.
I would agree with you. And the one thing that's interesting.
Or it's been made into one. Anyway.
Exactly. I think the net neutrality and the issue of the internet at broad is so new in the relative time period of our country. The idea that the internet is this free open space is so new. I mean, if you think back to the 1400s when Johann Gutenberg created the printing press, Martin Luther created the English Bible so people could read them. I mean, that was a mass communication change in that time. And the advent of the internet is one of these pivotal moments in humanity where information is really at your fingertips. I mean, that's how I get most of my information for these podcasts. I'm not going in books. No one really reads books for papers unless it's in a historical context. I mean, even medical information and literature, the shelves in medical libraries just collect dust because more relevant information comes out and it's just easier to store it on something like the net. So net neutrality is it is a neutral internet. It is a place and a construct where we can go. We shouldn't have any website that we go to limited in its broadband or limited in how quickly we can get to that website versus another website because our ISP, whether that's ISP, we'll use this term quite a bit, but definitely it's like your Verizon, your Comcast, your Xfinity, wherever you get your internet from is your ISP, your internet service provider.
Whoever you get it through at home, you know, for instance, your laptop, I mean, most people, I'm assuming, still don't get it through their cell provider. Maybe some people do, but on their phones, of course you do. But as far as at home using your laptop, that may be Cox or maybe Comcast. Back in the day, it was AOL. Mm-hmm. In fact, ISP is kind of more or less going defunct as a term, because there's very few solely internet-based media companies anymore. Yeah. Usually they're, well, we're going to get into that, mm-hmm. but it's more and more, they're bigger companies, but there's fewer of them. Mm-hmm. But the whole concept was, regardless of government, regardless of your creed, that there was this place called the internet. This has more or less been like the Wild West, and yeah, there's some dark, that, and I'm not referring to the dark web, but there's some dark elements of it, of course, with regardless of your views on it, the pervasive nature of pornography, of some of violence and whatnot, but also it was freedom of information, and that regardless of your viewpoint, you could express your opinion, and also it's a great, not to poo-poo on the internet, it's also been a place of great learning. Mm-hmm. Of, you know, Penn State, for instance, was one of the first correspondence programs, period. The school, university itself was established in 1855, but they had it very shortly thereafter, a number of correspondence learning programs, and as the mid-90s, they were one of the first schools to take the internet seriously and offer a plethora of serious undergraduate programs with companies that proctor these exams, mm-hmm. to ensure integrity. And that's just one example. There's a lot of good going on the internet, and a lot at stake.
Yes.
Which is why we would want to maintain net neutrality.
Exactly. So let me give you an example. This is sort of a extreme example of net neutrality gone wrong. But I had a friend when I was in early college, early university, who was living as an expat in Shanghai, China. And she had to do, like any person would have to do, projects for work, or for school, rather. And I remember her calling me on Skype and saying, hey, can you search, and I don't remember what the topic was, but it was a pretty seemingly innocuous topic. And because she was in China, she couldn't actually get any information on this topic because of what was censored on the internet. Now, that is an extreme example, but that was the first time it really hit me that, wow, I can't imagine being in another country and not being able to download something or read something because it's censored by the government. Net neutrality in the United States is a little different, but there is a lot at stake. It isn't necessarily limiting what you can see or censoring what you can see, but it is a slippery slope. We could get to that point. What we're at right now, and we'll try to do the best backstory we can without insulting the intelligence of our incredibly informed listenership, but net neutrality, if you can think back, I believe it was like 2014 or 2015 that essentially the FCC, or the Federal Communications Department, had to move net neutrality under Title I to Title II. And what that means is they had to reclassify...
Of the federal code.
Of the federal code. They had to reclassify these ISPs, or these internet service providers, from what they... So that what they wanted to do was establish these slow and fast lanes of broadband. That essentially meant they had the opportunity under Title I to limit certain sites that you would go visit, i.e., let's say Verizon had their own streaming Netflix. We'll call it Netflix 2.0. They think it's better than Netflix. So what they could do is they could slow down Netflix and make it faster to Netflix 2.0, which is their program. So if you were a viewer of Netflix, you would, without really knowing much about this net neutrality, you would be inclined to switch to Netflix 2.0 because it was faster and streamed better. So you might not even have known what was going on, but you did know that Netflix was slower, but Netflix 2.0 was better. And you switched to it and effectively gave Verizon $10 a month. So what the FCC did, or rather, they were reclassified under Title II as telecommunications. And what that did is it preserved net neutrality. And I don't know if I articulated that quite well, but they had these two choices to make: either label them as a telecommunications company, which would then protect the neutrality of the internet, or allow for these broadband fast and slow channels. So effectively, so that was put into effect. They were labeled telecommunications companies. So under the Trump administration, Donald Trump had appointed Ajit Pai, and so he became the new chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. So a little bit of backstory on Pai. He actually was, and this is a little bit of a conflict of interest when we get into this, when we talk about a little bit of crony capitalism with this, but he actually was counsel or legal counsel to Verizon at the time and was a very vocal vocal person when it came to deregulation and taking these ISPs, Verizon namely, off of Title II so that they could then, the argument.
So he's a proponent of the, it's not, none of this has been fully implemented. I mean, this takes years and years and years, but he's a proponent of this quote unquote deregulation. And I emphasize that we're going to get into just put an asterisk in your mind by deregulation here.
So at the time, Pai, as a counsel to Verizon, was very, very open about his desire to modernize FCC policies. And as his appointment to the federal chair the Federal Communications Commission, it was just a little, I mean, if anybody could raise their eyebrow at this sort of conflict of interest, when you look at an individual who was legal counsel, who was a huge proponent to roll back net neutrality under Title II, and his argument was that he would like to match the reality of the modern marketplace. And his argument was, and still is, that under Title II and these ISPs labeled as telecommunication companies, that it hindered their ability to invest in infrastructure, that there would be less investment over time in the infrastructure, internet communications infrastructure within the United States. Of note, when the FCC, or rather when these ISPs in Verizon, for example, use them, were classified under Title II, the CEO of Verizon got on with his shareholders and said, now I'm paraphrasing, but said, nothing about Title II will change how we invest in infrastructure. So that was very much upfront, very quickly, and I'm sure other CEOs at these ISPs said things very similarly to their shareholders. So Pai is still making the argument today that it hinders investment. And so this begs the question, okay, hold on a second. So if we take the ISPs and reclassify them back to Title I, and we put net neutrality at risk, meaning that you can limit broadband to one site, we can slow down one site to make one site faster, and you can essentially, you can essentially hinder and create sites to which you can gear your users to. And that seems a little antitrust, but you would ask that question, okay, Pi, so what, how do we protect net neutrality if we take this off Title II, take the classification off Title II? So he said that, well, it's very easy. The ISPs will voluntarily commit to the principles and we won't violate them. They'll be enforced by the Federal Trade Commission. The FCC won't touch it, and the Federal Trade Commission will be on top of that unfair, deceptive business practice. So what, just to be clear, what the chairman, who was a legal counsel to Verizon at one time, is saying that these companies, these corporations that have a vested interest in maintaining quarterly profits, will voluntarily commit to principles that will limit or stop unfair, deceptive business practices. Now, as a consumer of the free internet, I just have a bit of a hard time believing that any of these ISPs would voluntarily commit to these principles. I think in capitalism over time, mainly an example of the 2008 financial collapse, that these best practices are sometimes not implemented, or they are implemented and they just sort of crumble over time. I have gone on long enough about this.
No. It's quite all right.
It definitely opens up some conversations. And that being several, obviously net neutrality being one, and whether they should take away the Title II classification. And two, the issue with only a small group of individuals in levels of leadership that are making decisions, now I would say possible conflict of interests in place, are making decisions that will affect the greater population of the United States, 350 million people. Right. Now, before we get into this, there is a way that you can go and make your voice heard. And I'll put a link to this in the show notes, but the John Oliver Show actually bought the URL gofccyourself.com. And it actually does a link straight to where you can give your public opinion. And you just hit the, the extreme button, and you just click on that. And you can roll in and you give your information. I've already gone and done it. All you have to do is type in, if you believe that we should keep the net neutrality under Title II classification, that you just type in, please preserve net neutrality under Title II classification, and then you're good. And if you get enough, if they get enough public opinion, hopefully they will have to keep the classification under Title II. And we'll get into why we think that's important and why this idea of deregulation can actually set us up for, what's the word? Like, deregulation creates a case where we can have quite a monopoly oligarch type situation on our hands. So with that being said, it worries me that we would, I guess, if Pai himself, Ajit Pai, had no conflict of interest in the sense that he was a legal counsel for Verizon and has been pushing this for Verizon for the years that he worked there, and now he's the chairman of the FCC and he's deciding that we're going to deregulate this, where can we raise the red flag here?
There's several. One of which is, forget that he was a legal liaison for Verizon or whatever. On one front, what he's saying is the truth. These companies, these big companies, will indeed self-regulate, okay? Because obviously they're afraid of, it's like nuclear bombs being dropped. It's mutually assured destruction. Verizon doesn't want to play that dangerous game with AT&T or Cox or Comcast. For instance, if they play that game with Cox or Comcast, well, they're going to lose almost the entire South, okay, who uses those two companies in by and large for internet access. Where that's disingenuous, however, is when they're referring to anybody not in the Cool Kids Club. Okay, and what I mean by that is anybody not named Comcast, Cox, AT&T, Verizon, Sprint, all of these massive companies that are involved in this, this little Cool Kids Club are going to be the ones that we see that are, this is a boon to them, okay? Mm-hmm. Let's be very clear here. This is not free enterprise. This is not trickle-down economics. This is not capitalism, okay? This is a bastardization that is basically crony capitalism. And what I mean by that is the federal government, they're not actually picking the winners and losers here. By deregulating, they're actually doing a disservice here. And I know it probably sounds strange to hear coming from me because I am a largely laissez-faire economist, okay, a free enterprise thinker. However, there's a massive issue in that I think the internet has been miscategorized long enough. And I don't care if Title I, Title II, frankly, I think the entire federal code needs a massive, I'm not going to say overhaul, but we're just about there.
Well, yeah, I mean, okay. Title I, Title II, this was created, I think, in like 1939 when it came to communications.
But I think the federal code needs a federal overhaul is a different podcast, okay?
Indeed.
So for right now, I'm going to relegate the should it be Title One, Title Two? You can elaborate on that if you want. To me, that's not the central issue here. The central issue is that the internet has long enough not been termed what it is. And whether you want to call it a utility, whatever, it doesn't matter. To me, it is a massive societal good that warrants strong protection. And that's where I come from when I argue that, yes, I'm a free enterprise thinker, I'm a social liberal, but we need a strong but limited federal government, yes. But in this case, we need a strong central government to act, okay? And in this case, this is a massive federal good with, at the very outset of this podcast, I enumerated upon a number of examples of things that are not bad things. You know, there's enough stuff where it's like, okay, I get it. You know, we have a pretty strong handle on things like child porn because, you know, people get their doors kicked in and people go to prison over that. Okay, so let's look at, exactly. I'm not arguing against that. What I'm getting at is there are enough reasons, such as online learning and the online marketplaces, there are enough reasons for a strong action from the central government here. And the fact is, I believe Mr. Pai is telling the truth when it comes to how Verizon and AT&T will deal with one another. Where this comes into play for the everyday American is the vast majority of jobs, the vast majority of economic growth in this country comes from small business, meaning companies that, what's the statistic, have less than, what is it, 70 employees or 50 employees? It's a very small number.
It's a very small number, indeed.
Okay. Companies like ModState, for instance, that in the next year, and this, we're a small example, but that's the whole point in using ourselves here.
Yeah.
In the next year, we're hoping to have maybe 4 to 6 at most people that are receiving some semblance of salary and compensation, okay? So this is the Divinity Well Unlimited, the parent company of ModState. We're a perfect example of this, okay? In the sense that we have the luxury of having an embarrassment of riches in terms of IT knowledge, and we have a lot of intellectual wealth here at ModState. You know, we don't have a huge amount of money in the bank, but we do have 4, 5, and 6 people that are a phone call away. I'm someone who can help in the programming and the web administration, the network administration, and the graphic design. But we have 4, 5, 6 people that are an email away from saying, what you and I discussed previously is, our way around this is we'll set up our own ISP. We'll set up our own T1 server. We've got the, you know, we've got the optics to do this. We can make this happen, all right? And we don't need that many resources because we've got all the know-how. We can cut out a vast majority of the expenses here. The problem comes in that the vast majority of small businesses in this country, A, don't have such knowledge, and because of that, B, they're going to spend through the nose in a workaround here, so they're not going to be able to do it. They're going to have to go along with this game that's being pawned off as free market capitalism, as free enterprise, when in reality, that's the great paradox here. The great irony of this situation is that you're hearing these quote-unquote free market thinkers, these big businessmen, right, and they're giving carte blanche because it's a Republican administration with a Republican congressman. And I'm saying this, folks, as someone who is a, yes, it's a foregone era, but as a Nixon Republican thinker, okay, I'm warning you, this deregulation is, in reality, it's setting up 6, maybe a handful more, you know, whatever I'm estimating right now. But I'm telling you right now, there will be no more than 10, 12 winners at most from this in terms of the corporate world.
Absolutely.
Okay, by it's very disingenuous. It's like, we're deregulating. Isn't that great, folks? Well, what you're doing is you're removing the only central controls that are ensuring a balanced playing field, in that a small company like a Divinity Well Unlimited can play in the same field. And where this comes into play for you, the small business owner, is unless, because, oh, Nate, rest assured, they'll let you have access to the faster speeds. Sure they will, but you're going to pay for it.
Yes, exactly.
You're going to pay through the nose. You're going to pay a premium. So what they're doing is they're creating second-class citizens. They're creating serfdom on the web. Either you pay to play at these higher rates, or you can't afford it. Well, welcome to the serfs.
So it's actually this weird, it's a weird concept, because the internet itself is inherently this wild west, right? So if you look at conservative values and deregulation, the internet itself, there's no real regulation on where I can and cannot go on my laptop right
That's
now.
That's where I argue it's a special circumstance.
It is.
I don't want to go so far as to call it a utility, because then people are going to say that we can tax it. And I know we have enough taxes in this country. If you don't believe me, look at your next hotel bill.
Well, yes. Right? And if you were to tax it as well, then there would be an argument for absolute equal access to every individual in the United right. States, which at this point is probably, as we're finding out, dropped calls, not being able to log on. I mean, in some right. places in the United States, you still can't even dial 911 on your phone.
Right. So you're creating, to me, to out and out say it's utility is kind of a disaster in the making. But so is this. What I argue is that there are some things that are special circumstances. Anybody that says that I'm being a hack here, no, I'm not. We have different laws for maritime trade. Okay, there's a whole category of law for things that go on in disputed waters internationally. So no, I'm not being a hack here when I say this, because I've heard that response before. Well, no, the internet is a special good, and it needs, I'm not saying it needs to be the Wild West, but we need to have minimal, you can sell this or you can't sell this, okay? I like where we're at with the laws regarding, as you said before, child pornography, things like that, the drug trade should be prosecuted, okay?
Yes, because it's illegal anyway. So yes, by whatever
we're okay, for instance, with states selling and taxing and regulating marijuana, for instance. I'm not okay with somebody selling it because we don't even know what that is. You know, the exactly. FDA doesn't even get to regulate that. Where this is dangerous is, again, we're deregulating. Well, what you're doing is you're removing oversight and saying, all right, this handful of companies with billions of dollars, and last I checked, it's very difficult to get that kind of cash as a startup. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's no new players going to get to play at this table. And sure, you can have these speeds, but they're not telling you. The big asterisk here is this deregulation is basically like saying, we're going to deregulate the federal highway system. And, but only these people that pay this toll are going to get to use the highways. The rest of you can use dirt roads and like it.
Mm-hmm. Or horse and buggy again, or whatever.
Yeah, that's basically what this is. So don't buy. I'm urging people, the free market thinkers out there, so am I. But this is not the same thing as saying we're going to allow you, we're going to stop paying farmers to not farm. This is not the same thing as saying, you know, we're going to deregulate certain types of firearm stocks, okay? This is a different ballgame where they're saying, yeah, we're going to deregulate, but it's more akin to the federal government not regulating what goes in your drinking water.
Exactly. So essentially what they're trying to do is it would be a boon or a gain for these ISP corporations. And you're essentially fixing something. So deregulation, I think, inherently, in some cases, is good. It's positive. But it's like you're fixing something that isn't broken in the sense of regulation. And there, like you said and you alluded to earlier, that the regulation and the strong regulation that currently holds these ISPs to the form of telecommunications is protecting your ability to go anywhere on the internet at this point. And if you are a small business owner, it allows you a competitive edge against every other small business owner. And in the case where we could set up our own server, under these, or would have the ability to do that, you could be right. hindered.
We have a leg up that a lot of other companies, I mean, finish, and we'll set that up more in a minute. Finish what you're going at, but I think we're not trying to be, we're not having hubris here by using ourselves as an example, but continue.
Well, no, I think it's a good example. But overall, to the red flag for me is the creation of these companies that will allow little to no competition given the opportunity that they would like. And any way that you sugarcoat it, there's still questions that are being raised. And this can go as far as a Comcast or a Verizon blocking their terms of agreement or their mission statements or ethics or their perspective outlook on the market and what they'd like to do. Because again, these companies are bound by law to be transparent to their shareholders. So when you're talking about companies that are worth billions of dollars, not only are we stuck with a situation where the average American can't lobby their senators, they can't lobby their congressmen, they can't lobby those that are in government, where these ISPs have money to push and persuade those who are in the inner workings of the government to do things like roll back Title II. And
well, that's an interesting thought. I want to pause you there. I want you to continue, but I want people to think about that as a perfect example. The power, and this is where it's very disingenuous for the word deregulation to be used here. Because again, think of this not of, oh, well, this deregulation means they're going to stop, you know, they're going to allow Americans to produce, for instance, as part of NAFTA, we have regulations that prevent farmers from producing certain crops here because we buy those products from Mexico. And there's a reason for those regulations as part of that trade agreement. This is more akin to the government saying, you know what, Richard Nixon didn't know what the hell he was thinking. GM, go ahead and resume dumping corporate waste into the Flint River. We don't mind our kids having lead poisoning. That's what this is more akin to, because again, the internet is a special circumstance, and this deregulation is not helping the free market. And the proof in the pudding is, if it was helping the free market, it would be diversifying the overall pool of people, allowing the pool of people sitting at the table that are playing the game to expand. In reality, what this is doing is shrinking the possible number of players at the table. That is, does not sound like free enterprise to me when the move is actually inhibiting. It is going to hamstring people from entering the market. Mm-hmm. So when they say deregulation here, what they actually mean is we're going to deregulate because we don't see a need to have a free market system here. Mm-hmm. We want to create a monopoly of players that are easier to control. The government can have more control over 6 to 8 companies involved as opposed to potentially 250.
Exactly. And so what I am afraid is that when it's framed as deregulation, that people would think then that they would have more access to the internet.
They're using that word.
Exactly. Deregulation somehow would make people think, who are proponents of deregulation, that somehow their internet will be faster, they'll have more access to sites that they've never had before.
Exactly, because we're talking about people have been misled. It's not the fault of the everyday good Americans. I'm not insulting them. They've been misled to believe that this is no different than, you know, the municipal waterworks or the highway system or the electric bill. This is very different because this is how the vast majority, as you said, you got dust on libraries books, okay? This is how the vast majority of the free world gets everything, all of their information. That's where this is different, okay? Mm-hmm. And why it's disingenuous. Oh, we're deregulating, all right? We don't have a need to regulate your little company anymore because you don't have a chance to play ball.
Exactly. Now, in his defense, he did say that these voluntary commitments would be enforced by the Federal Trade Commission. But what that really is doing is,
if they report it.
Exactly. So
that's based on self-reporting. And okay, so, they're going to tattle on themselves?
Well, that, and even if a Joe Blow in Detroit, Michigan, filed a complaint to the Federal Trade Commission and said, hey, I noticed that Netflix is slower than Netflix 2.0, and you can find that easily on every website that you go to. It creates a... When you have the firm ruling or the firm code of Title II, and then you deregulate and then leave the Federal Trade Commission to enforce these practices.
Oh, and there's another problem, my friend.
You're essentially creating a less strong bastion of
regulation. It
gets
more brutal.
Please go.
It gets more brutal. Well, no, I want you to, you're going to love this one. I think I'm reminding you of something here. You're going to really take off here. And people, this is not conspiracy. This is what's really going on, okay? The IG of every, the inspectors general of every department and the number of U.S. attorneys related to the Justice Department capable of prosecuting this have had the shit cut out of their budget. lawyers dismissed. They're not there to possibly enforce a watchdog this.
No.
So this is, again, duly disingenuous. Go, take this, Nate.
So that, I mean, this goes beyond just net neutrality. When it comes to federal prosecutors who are in the place to investigate and charge individuals when they use deceptive business practices.
To protect the free enterprise system.
So, it, like, for example, we had the Panama Papers that came out. And for those of you who don't know what the Panama Papers are, they were essentially an investigative journalist group that found that the very, very well-connected and wealthy individuals throughout the world were actually taking the money that they owned and creating shell companies in other countries and then funneling the money made into offshore bank accounts so that they wouldn't be taxed. So you would say, well, that seems like that would be the job of federal prosecutors. That becomes very difficult because of a budget, resource, and time in order to do that. There currently is a group of around 400 individuals that are exploring the greater reaches of the Panama Papers and these connected individuals. And even with 400 full-time working investigative journalists, it still is an intense...
That's not federal oversight, though.
That isn't. And we need that journalism there to do this. But my point being...
We also need a strong government capable of intervening if law has been broken.
Exactly. So even with all these journalists, it's still taking forever to be able to even find these links. So to then,
guess what? We had a big case of this, Nate, in the 1990s that was decided where, I don't know, it was inappropriate for carcinogens contained in cigarettes, you know, had been, it was proven. They could say, no, all they want to, it had been proven that they had marketed to minors, okay? And guess who prosecuted those cases? Yes, there were state governorships that did as well, but it was U.S. attorneys. The Justice Department got involved, but guess what? Those lawyers aren't going to be there because the funding's not there.
Exactly. So you're effectively hamstringing the process by leaving this to the Federal Trade Commission and federal prosecutors to go down this road. You would need to make a whole nother branch of federal prosecutors just to have oversight here, and intense amount of hiring actions by the Federal Trade Commission, which you won't get because the current administration is cutting back federal hiring actions. So you have to think here, and you have to think and really research this when we get down to the nuts and bolts of oversight and the current deregulation that's proposed on the table, or that's on the table. It worries me and bothers me.
It should worry any free market thinker, anybody who cares about there not being, you know, no, it's not a monopoly in the sense that there's not one, but there might as well be, because here's the thing. You know, it just struck me, Nate. This isn't deregulation, as you and I have been arguing all along. You know what this is? Even though he's no longer in the federal government, this is what Steve Bannon was talking about when he said, I'm going up there to D.C., he said, and he's still doing it subversively behind the scenes because he's still a part of this quote-unquote shadow government, ironically. The destruction of the federal administrative state. That's what this is.
It is. Yeah, 100%.
This is not deregulation.
And in some cases, deregulation is a good thing. But in this case, a blanketed deregulation, and especially in this terms, is incredibly destructive to the information that you have available to at your fingertips every single day. And you know what? Even if it was enacted and over time it was implemented, you might not see a huge difference. And it might be that insidious.
There shouldn't be any difference.
There shouldn't.
That's the whole point here, is that it's creating a serfdom. It's creating a second-class citizenry on the web. And granted, I could look at this and go, I mean, selfishly, I could go, well, for my education, I'm attending Pennsylvania State, you know, Penn State. And like I said, they have taken correspondence learning seriously from day one. They've taken the internet seriously. So the World Campus, you know, I'm not going to have anything to worry about. It's a public institution, A. B, Penn State has, you know, enough endowments to burn a horde of wet dogs with, you know, for fun if they wanted to, and it wouldn't even matter. And then, again, with Divinity Well Unlimited, we've got enough IT resources, people, not excluding myself, my decade plus of experience in it, we've got enough people and private resources that without even expending much of our budget, we could set up a server and around this, you know, and I think it's something we're seriously going to pursue.
Yeah.
But what about the people out there, the small businesses out there that don't have these resources? Granted, it would be a competitive advantage to you and I, but it would be a disservice to the free enterprise system and to the American people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you got to think about this in broad terms here. And I know
exactly.
You are, but that's why we're so ardently pursuing this, because as we talked about before the podcast, you couple this with the repeal of the Smith-Blunt Act, the Propaganda Act of 1948, maybe somebody out there and go, wait a minute, that's a reach. Is it really? Mm-hmm. Look at these two things juxtaposed. The removal of competitive oversight from the internet and the repeal of the Propaganda Act. Oh, and it just so happens that both items benefit in a media monopoly.
Yeah.
That's a mighty enormous coincidence,
and
I suppose.
And to make pick an example, let's say that these ISPs would voluntarily commit to their principles of not limiting any sort of access that you have to the internet or sites that you go to. I would challenge you to make the analogy to the 2008 financial crisis, where these banks, these lenders, were held voluntarily to these principles that they had and essentially collapsed the economy, almost the world economy. Now, go back and look. Who got prosecuted for that? No one. No one got prosecuted for it. Whether that's money being shuffled around so that people aren't being held accountable for it, or it's because of lack of resources at the federal level, the judicial level, I don't know. But to think that you can hold these companies voluntarily accountable and then have an inability or a weakened ability to prosecute and investigate is a double whammy to the system on top of not allowing competition.
Let's look back and forget the fact that nobody hardly did. In fact, there was one individual who was a low-level CPA. Per Mr. Coker's research, he worked on this housing crisis research for one of his classes for his master's in political science. One low-level CPA was prosecuted and jailed for a few months of the whole housing crisis. What was done, it was criminal, okay?
100%.
Not only was there usury involved. Look at, real quick, a 90-second synopsis like I gave him, because it just so happened this was one of my areas of expertise. I mean, the guy's brilliant, obviously, and just, I was flattered he consulted me on this. But real quick, what was done with the approval of men like Senator Ted Kennedy and John McCain, so it's bipartisan bullshit here, but they allowed banks to engage in subprime loans where they said to someone that couldn't afford, as much house as they ended up getting loaned, well, hey, don't worry, we'll loan you this massive sum for a low interest rate, but it can be raised as, quote unquote, the market dictates. So you had mortgages going from 2% to 40%, and no, I'm not exaggerating. People, like, it was worse in some circumstances. That was mild, 2% to 40%. And so then, shock of all shocks, who benefited from that? Well, the banks, basically what happened was these people that paid on this house for 10 to 12 months, and then that same bank that lent the money repossessed the property. So in essence, they were getting free, they just had pure and unadulterated profit. They had all these payments that would then, you lose your equity in whether it's a car or property, whatever, when it's repossessed. So the banks got all this money, but they screwed themselves temporarily because they realized, well, wait a minute, way too many people in middle America have lost their homes. So, oh my God. And so then they go to Congress for a bailout. They get it.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, it was estimated $7 trillion in equity and real estate wealth was lost, okay? But at the end of the day, all of those, they say savings get passed along. Well, in this case, all the losses were passed along. Guess who didn't get bailed out? The people that lost their homes. Mm-hmm. Guess who's not getting bailed out? The $2 trillion worth in student loan debts. So I always love when people say, well, that's socialism to bail out $2 trillion worth of student loans. Really? Mm-hmm. So what do you call the bailout to the banks who created the problem?
Yes.
I mean, it was a Ponzi scheme. They said, hey, we're going to loan this out, money that they should have never been loaning to begin with. And they didn't even quadruple. I mean, pentuple. I mean, just astronomical raising exponential raising of the interest rates to people that couldn't afford it to begin with.
Exactly.
That's usury, Nate.
And who picked up the bill?
There's usury. Yes. Then they seize those properties from the people that they loaned it to that should have never had that money. So those people got foreclosed on, and the banks that loaned these users' loans in the first place profited from the seizure. Then who picked up the bill because of their Ponzi scheme?
Taxpayer.
The American people, who then, oh, by the way, sorry, you know, too bad, so sad. There's no bailout for you on the student loans that we've loaned you, because the whole, oh, we'll get your degree and fork over this money now, we'll have jobs waiting for you at the Milan. Oh, guess what? That was bullshit, too.
Yep.
So they want to know why middle America is, oh, I can't have a town hall because they'll scream at me.
Exactly. So that is a good analogy of what can happen with deregulation. Now, obviously, I don't think that we're making the assumption that these ISPs voluntarily committing themselves is going to create some financial collapse, but it just goes to show you that these institutions were voluntarily committed to practices and principle. And when you have money at stake, when you have power at stake, and when you have vast amounts of money that you need to keep making quarterly for your shareholders and your corporation, sometimes those voluntary practices get a little blurred. And if you've got no one there to enforce it to the best ability as they should be, i.e., if the Federal Trade Commission could enforce it the same way Title II enforces it, then I'm fine. But I don't think any American is satisfied that the Federal Trade Commission could reach to those that type of regulation that Title II classification does currently. It will not.
You're not going to see a financial crisis on that level, no, because we're not talking about securities. We're not talking about mortgage-backed securities, things like that. It's not going to be a congressionally sanctioned Ponzi and usury swap, you know. You're going to see, again, first and second class and so on citizens, you're going to have serfdom on the web as far as, well, you know, you can get all this and no problem what you're going to pay. And also, the bigger issue here, no, you're not going to see a collapse in the system, but what you're going to see is a whole generation of people who will never have the opportunity to grow a business into a burgeoning telecommunications company. There will be no new money, if you will. There'll be no American dream type middle class guys in a garage creating an ISP and then turning it into billions. You know, it's ironic, the Elon Musks and the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world out there who develop such things, the Papa Johns of the world, if you will, they're doing everything in their power with these type moves to inhibit people from doing what they did.
Exactly.
And building the American dream. They're doing what they can. So there's the real loss here. No, there won't be a collapse of the internet economy, but they're going to do their damnedest, Nate, to make sure that if guys like you and I do succeed in this, that we're amongst the last of the wave to do so.
I believe you are correct in that. So just to remind listeners, I'm going to post in the show notes a link that will take you to allow for your public opinion. And if there is enough public opinion, then the FCC actually can't go ahead and reclassify net neutrality under Title I. So it's up to the public, and it's up to you whether or not this is boring to you or not. It is insidious and will absolutely affect you, as laid out by, well articulated by John. And
well, not being
myself.
Able to start a business and staying in the lower levels, the lower recesses of the economy is pretty boring, too. So there's one thing I will tell you. I'll also wrap up one of the things I want to add into this editorial now that I'm posting. Maybe it'll be a series, but there's a part of our app that we've been working on is very readily, with a swipe of your thumb, you can see who your senators are and who your one representative is. That's something I'm going to add to this editorial that we'll put front and center, social media and on the site, is saying, you know, hey, these guys don't want to have town halls because you might yell at them. Well, en masse, they will respond to massive, I promise you they will, because they've done it. I've seen it personally. They will respond to en masse communications from the taxpayers and their constituents, because you are the ones, especially with representatives, they're accountable to you every 24 months. Let them know what mm-hmm. they're facing if they go against the will of the American people.
Yep. It's so vitally important. It's a civic responsibility to do that. And by doing that, John, I think that will do wonders. And it's just another outlet for people to be able to reach and find who their lawmakers are. And this is just one topic that, though doesn't seem that exciting or relevant or needed, it is incredibly important. And I'm glad that we have the platform to be able to do this. It's incredibly important to get it out there.
Indeed.
So
we're out there. We're going to persist in this. Absolutely.
Indeed.
We're putting some things together, and absolutely we're thankful for the readership. If nothing else, I know you've kind of wondered probably at times, man, these guys talk about their growth and their numbers a lot. And there's a reason why, because as we put together some things for our electronic press kit, or EPK, and we talk to potential sponsors and potential investors, you're going to see we're very transparent businessmen. No, we're not a publicly traded company, but we're going to continue to be transparent, because you're going to see exactly where our resources are going. And it is because we want to expose this kind of flawed potential policy and say, no, the American people, no, they're doing a lot of dollar voting here. And no, the Mod State readership is prepared to go to the polls and send you guys home.
Absolutely. So for that, please engage us at modstate.com. All of our social media outlets, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. You can find the Mod State. That's the Twitter handle. And then I've got my Nate Welland_ModState. Please engage. If you have any questions on how to get to the public opinion site at the FCC, please let us know. I'm going to put a link in the show notes. If you've got any other questions, anything to add to this, please engage us. Please talk to us. If you've got an opposing viewpoint about this, I would love to hear from you and how it will benefit you and Americans by reclassifying.
If there's a better way, please, by all means, let us know. Because if nothing else, I promise you this, Nate and I are going to err on the side of the American people and their individual freedoms, and in this case, for your ability to start a tech business and compete on level footing.
Absolutely.
So with that, I bid you adieu, au revoir.
All right, we'll see ya.
Yeah, they always ask me, Ali, what you saying?